It was at that moment that a deputation arrived, headed by Joseph, to tell us that some unknown and foolish person had left the taps open on 4 of the water tanks. We had 35 gallons of water between 17 people to last the rest of the trip. Therefore, added Joseph with evident relish, we will have to leave this place tomorrow and return to the nearest water on the Mound Road. There were a few expressions of disgust at this latest and clearly deliberate setback, but none of us could work up any real anger. All right, Joseph, Loren agreed with resignation. Break camp tomorrow. We'll leave before lunch. There was an immediate improvement in employer-employee relations. I even noticed a few smiles and heard a little laughter from the cooking fire. I don't know what you two intend doing this afternoon, and Loren lit a cigar as he spoke, but I noticed elephant spoor when I did my little recce this morning. I'm taking the Land Rover and the gunberries. Don't worry if I don't arrive back tonight. We may get hung up on the spoor. Sally looked up quickly, and for a moment I thought she was going to start her anti-blood sport again, but instead she merely frowned and went back to her ham. I watched the Land Rover drive off along the base of the cliff. Before I suggested to Sally, I'm going to try to find a path up to the top. Do you want to come along? Oh, deal me out, Ben, she answers. I think I'll do some sketching this afternoon. Hiding my disappointment as best I could, I set off along the base of the cliff. And within half a mile, I'd found a game trail leading into one of the bush-choked gullies that furrowed the face of Red Rock. It was a steep climb, and I toiled up with the sun burning onto my back and bouncing off the rock into my face. From cracks and crannies in the cliff face, an army of furry little rock rabbits watched my endeavors with avid interest. It was 40 minutes before I came out on the top, my arms scratched by the thorny undergrowth of the gully and sweat soaking my shirt. I found a good vantage point on the front edge of the cliff under the spreading shade of a giant euphorbia, and my first concern was to sweep with the binoculars for any trace of ruins. The thorn bush at the base of the cliff below me was fairly open and scantily grassed, and immediately it was obvious that there was no trace of any human habitation or cultivation. I shouldn't really have hoped for more, but disappointment gave a sickening little lurch in my guts. Then I dismissed it and turned the glasses towards the camp far below. A Bantu was cutting firewood, and for a while I amused myself by watching the axe stroke and then listening for the sound of the blow seconds later. I searched further from the camp and picked up Sally's rose-colored blouse at the edge of the grove. She'd obviously given up all hope of a major discovery, and sensible girl was deriving what other enjoyment she could from the expedition. I watched her for a long time, trying to decide how exactly to proceed with my campaign to make her my own. I had spent one night with her, but I wasn't so naive as to believe that this proved a breathless and undying passion on behalf of a sophisticated, highly intelligent and extravagantly educated modern miss. Angel that she was, yet I was pretty damned certain that my Sally had played the game with other men before Dr. Ben stumbled starry-eyed into her bed. The odds were extremely high. She'd been motivated by respect for my mind rather than my body. Pity. And possibly a little perverse curiosity. However, I was almost certain she'd not found the experience too repulsive, and I'd only to keep working on her to change respect and pity into something a little deeper and more permanent. A good, quiet sense of peace came over me as I sat there on the high krantz. Slowly I realized that this whole journey had been worthwhile, and I found myself wishing that I could stay longer at these haunting hills of blood, with their mystery and silent beauty. Sally and I, together here in the wilderness, where I could teach her to love me. A flicker of movement in the corner of my eye made me turn my head slowly, and within 6 feet of where I sat, a Mariko sunbird was sucking the nectar from the blossoms of a wild aloe, its metallic green head shimmering as it dipped the long, curved bill into the fiery red blossoms. I watched it with intense pleasure, and when it was gone, on quick, darting wings, I felt as though I'd missed something. The feeling became stronger, making me restless. There was a message somewhere that was trying to come through to me, but it was being blocked. I let my brain relax and had the feeling that it was just there at the very fringe of my conscious mind. Another second, and I would have it. Dull on the hot, breathless hush of afternoon, the double boom-boom of distant heavy gunfire jerked my attention away. I sat up and listened for another 30 seconds, and then it came again. Boom, and again. Lorin had found his elephant. I picked Sally up in the field of the binoculars. She'd heard it also and was standing away from her easel, staring out into the bush. I stood up also, my sudden restlessness still persisting, and started down the cliff path again. I could not shake off the mood, and it grew stronger. There is something here, I thought, something strange and inexplicable. "You and I are lucky, my friend," Timothy McGeeber had told me once. "We are marked by the spirit, and we have the eye within that can see beyond, and the ear that can catch the sounds of silence." It was cool now in the heavily shaded gully, and my shirt was still damp with sweat. I felt the goose pimples rising on my skin, but not entirely from the chill. I began to hurry. I wanted to get back to the camp and Sally. For dinner that night, we ate grilled elephant heart, sliced thin and covered with a biting pepper sauce, served with potatoes roasted in their jackets. The beer was icy cold, as Lorin had promised, and he was in an expansive mood. It had been a good day's hunt, fully compensating him for the other disappointments. Lying in the lantern light beyond the fire were four long, curved yellow tusks of ivory. When Lorin sets out to be charming, he is irresistible. Although Sally tried to maintain a disapproving attitude at first, she soon succumbed to his charisma, and she laughed with us when Lorin gave us the toast to the city that never was and the treasure we didn't find. I went to bed a little drunk, and I dreamed strange dreams. But I woke in the morning clear-headed and with an unformed sense of excitement buoying me, as though today something good was going to happen. The helicopter came out of the south an hour before noon, drawn to us by the smudge fires of oil-soaked rag. It sank noisily down towards the camp on its glistening silver rotor and raised a whirlwind of dust and debris. There was a brief conference with the dark-haired young pilot, then Lorin climbed into the seat beside him, and the ungainly craft lifted into the air once more, and began a series of sweeps along the cliffs, rising higher with each pass, until it was a dark insect speck in the aching blue of that hot, high sky. Its manoeuvres were so clearly indicative of failure that Sally and I soon lost interest and went to sit in the shade of the dining tent. "Well," she said, "that's that, I guess." I didn't answer her, but went to the refrigerator and brought us each a can of Windhoek. For the first time in days, the fabled Cousin Brain began running on all cylinders. 30 gallons of water shared between two persons meant a gallon a day for 2 weeks. Water. There was something else about water in the back of my mind. Sally and water. The helicopter landed once more on the outskirts of the camp, and Lorin and the pilot came to the tent. Lorin shook his head. "No go. Nothing. We'll have a bite of lunch and be on our way. Leave you to make the best of it home." I nodded agreement, not telling him my plans to forestall any argument. "Well, Ben, I'm sorry about this. I just can't understand it. And Lurin began building himself a sandwich of bread and cold slices of roast Gemsbok fillet, smearing it with mustard. Anyway, it won't be the last disappointment we'll ever have in our lives. 20 minutes later, Lurin's essential baggage was packed in the helicopter, and while the pilot started the motor, we said our farewells. I'll see you back in Jolly Joburg. Look after those tusks for me. Good trip, Lo. All the way, partner? All the way, Lo. And then he was ducking under the spinning rotor and climbing into the passenger seat of the helicopter. It rose in the air like a fat bumblebee and clattered away over the treetops. Bumblebee. Bee. Bee. My God, that was what had been niggling me. Bees, birds, and monkeys. I grabbed Sally's arm, my excitement startling her. Sally, we're staying. What? And she gaped at me. There are things here we've overlooked. Like what? The birds and the bees, I told her. Why, you randy old thing, she said. We split the water, 15 to 20 gallons. That would give the servants a little over half a gallon a day each for 2 days, sufficient to get them out safely. Sally and I would have a full gallon a day for 10 days. I kept the Land Rover, making sure the petrol tanks were full, and there were 25 gallons in the emergency cans. I also kept the radio, one tent, bedding, a selection of tools including spade, axe, and pick, rope, gas lanterns and spare cylinders, torches and spare batteries, tinned food, Lurin's shotgun, and half a dozen packets of shells, together with all of Sally's and my personal gear. All the rest of the equipment was loaded onto the two trucks, and when the servants were all on board, I took the old Matabele gunbearer aside. My old and respected father, I spoke in Sindabili, I have heard you speak of a great mystery that lives in this place. I ask you now, as a son and a friend, to speak to me of these things. It took him a few seconds to get over his astonishment, and then I went on to speak a sentence that Timothy McGeeba had given me. It is a secret code, a recognition signal used at a high level among the initiates to the mysteries. The old man gasped. He could not question me now, nor could he ignore my appeal. My son, then he spoke softly, if you know those words, then you should know of the legend. At a time when the rocks were soft and the air was misty, an expression of the uttermost antiquity, there was an abomination and an evil in this place which was put down by our ancestors. They placed a death curse upon these hills, and commanded that this evil be cleaned from the earth and from the minds of men forever. Again, those fateful words repeated exactly. And that is the whole legend? I asked. Nothing else? There is nothing else, the old man told me, and I knew it was the truth. We went back to the waiting lorries, and I spoke to Joseph first in Shangaan. Go in peace, my friend. Drive carefully and care well for those who ride with you, for they are precious to me. Joseph gaped at me, his wits scattered. I turned to the camp boys and changed to Sequana. The spider gives you greetings and wishes you peace. There was consternation amongst them as I used my nickname. But when they drove away, they'd recovered from the shock and were laughing delightedly at the joke. The trucks disappeared amongst the thorn trees, and the sound of their motors dwindled into the eternal silence of the deep bush. You know, Sally murmured reflectively, I think I've been took. Here I am, stranded 200 miles from anywhere with a man whose morals are definitely suspect. And then she giggled. And isn't it lovely? She asked. I had found a spot on the top of the cliff where I could lean out over the drop, supported by a hefty young baboon apple tree, and obtain a good view of the rock screen on either side, as well as over the open plain below. Sally was down beyond the silent grove, and I could see her clearly. The sun seemed at the right angle for her, although it was shining directly into my eyes. It was only 10 or 15 degrees above the horizon now, and the golden rays brought out new, soft colours from rock and foliage. Sally's shout carried faintly up to me, and she held both hands straight up towards the sky. It was the signal we had evolved to mean, "Come back towards me." "Good," I grunted. "She must have picked them up." I had explained to her carefully how to shade her eyes against the slant of the sun's rays, and to watch for the arrow straight flight of the tiny golden motes of light. It was an old trick used by bee hunters to find the hive. A bushman had taught it to me.